Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. I'm Dawn Davenport, your intrepid host. I'm an attorney and a writer specializing in the area of infertility and adoption and children's issues. I'm the author of The Complete Book of International Adoption, a step-by-step guide to finding your child, published by Random House. I also have a website that focuses on infertility and all forms of adoption. The name of the site has recently changed, and it is changed to Creating a Family, and can be found, I guess not so surprisingly, at creatingafamily.com. This show is live every Wednesday from 12 to 1 Eastern Time, and all the old shows are available at creatingafamily.com, so you can listen to them whenever, and thanks to the miracle of podcast, wherever you want. Today is the second show of a three-part series on the dilemma faced by couples who have frozen embryos left over when they finish with infertility treatment. I've called this issue of what to do with the excess frozen embryos the third rail of infertility because it seems like no one wants to talk about it. But everyone who has these embryos or is helping to create them is thinking about it. It's become such a politicized and polarized subject that I hear from people that are trying to decide that they're afraid to talk about it for fear of being judged. And this seems to be the case regardless of what option they're considering. So this series of shows is intended to open up the discussion and provide information on all options available. Today's show will cover the option of donating embryos to another infertile couple to help them create a family. The first show last week, May 21st, was a general overview of all options and what people are deciding, and we spent time talking about the thaw and discard option. The last show, which will be next week, June 4th, will be on donating the excess embryos to research. For today's show, I have a great lineup of guests. Dr. Jeffrey Keenan, who is the medical director of the Southeastern Fertility Clinic in Knoxville, as well as the director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at the University of Tennessee College of Medicine, and, last but not least, medical director of the National Embryo Donation Center in Knoxville, is one guest. Another guest is Ruth Claiborne. She is an attorney in Atlanta, Georgia, with Claiborne, Outman, and Surme. She is an attorney specializing in reproductive technology and adoption law, and she has been doing this for the past 17 years. We also have Deborah Bond. She is a former IVF patient and an anonymous embryo donor, and Suzanne Gray, who is also a former IVF patient and an embryo donor in an open adoption. Welcome to you all, and thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Good. I'd like to start with Deborah and Suzanne because, after all, you guys are the real experts. Deborah, how many embryos did you have left over when you and your husband decided that your family was complete?
That was in our second IVF round, and I believe we had 5 viable embryos left over.
And they were frozen, and you and your husband said, okay, you know, really, you had two children, a boy and a girl, right?
No, two girls.
Two girls, that's right. I'm sorry. Deborah, okay, you had two girls, and you decided this was enough. So tell me, walk me through the process. I mean, what were your options that you were considering, and how did you end up with the decision to donate your embryos?
Well, we had thought about, we seriously considered trying to use them because the chances of conceiving with a frozen embryo aren't so great. So we thought if we only had 5, the chance of getting pregnant with 1 or 2 babies was decent, and we thought about trying it, but we sort of thought that we were finished and 2 was as many children as we could handle, and we also thought that if we did get pregnant on the first try with 1 of the 5, we would be faced with the same dilemma with the remaining 4 embryos. So no matter what, choosing to implant them to avoid a tough decision probably wasn't going to work. So we just,
you know, it's funny. I hear that from a lot of people I talk with. It's I haven't seen any statistics on it, but so many people I interview, I'm researching a book on the subject of embryo disposition, and so many of the people that I'm interviewing have said exactly that if they had fewer embryos, they would be more likely to say, well, what the heck, let's just see what happens and implant, go for another one. So it makes you feel any better, you're not alone.
Well, that's good. I think we probably are typical in a lot of ways. But we ultimately decided that we had a toddler and we had a baby, and we had a lot on our plate and decided that for our life, that was the right amount of children, and we needed to figure out what to do with them. And for us, we decided adoption was the best way to go because we felt like we'd put our hearts and souls and prayer and everything into creating these embryos and the children that resulted from them, and we simply couldn't destroy them. We couldn't throw them away.
And that would include, I guess I should start by saying the options that people have when faced with excess frozen embryo are, one, as you have nicely summarized, to try for another pregnancy.
Right.
The second one would, in no order here, would be to donate to another infertile couple. The
right.
third would be to donate for research, and the
mm-hmm.
fourth would be to thaw
Simply
and
let
discard.
Them thaw.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
thaw and discard. And then I always include a fifth one, and that is indefinite storage, or deciding
right.
not to decide. So I will throw that one out. So anyway, but you decided that of those options, the only one. Now, had you gone into this giving much thought before you created the embryos as to what you would do if you had leftovers?
Somewhat. I think we put some thought into it because we actually contacted an attorney before we signed an IVF contract to make sure that the embryos would not be destroyed in the event of our deaths or a divorce. So we had thought about it esoterically, but we really hadn't thought about it in
mm-hmm.
a real way until it came down to making the real decision.
Yeah.
It's one thing to put the words on paper, and it's another thing to actually
mm-hmm.
donate them for adoption.
Well, and so many people the vast majority, when they're beginning, I mean, they're hoping to create any embryo, much less, I mean, even the thought of that they might be so fortunate to have that choice of have enough embryos to freeze is something that most people aren't going into this thinking.
And we thought that, too, because our friends had been successful in conceiving but had very few embryos and none left.
Yeah. Now, Suzanne, you had a plethora of embryos and eggs. Tell us about how many embryos you had frozen after you had four children and then decided that your family was complete. How many embryos did you have frozen at that point?
Yeah, we're on more of the shock side of the spectrum. We had 23 embryos left over, and that was, I think, mostly due to an IVF cycle that wasn't as closely managed as it probably should have been. And then at the time we were doing this in 1995, we didn't know enough to even prevent that number of eggs being fertilized in order to try to control what that was going to mean down the road long term for us.
Dr. Keenan, are people more cautious now? If somebody had, you told me, I think, Suzanne, you had like 30 or 33 eggs?
33 eggs aspirated.
33 eggs. You know, I still hear of doctors fertilizing that many because, again, they don't know how many will actually grow into embryos. Dr. Keenan, what is kind of standard practice now if somebody were to produce 33 eggs?
Well, Dawn, I think, unfortunately, it is still standard practice to inseminate all the oocytes that are retrieved. And that's something that, frankly, I disagree with because then you are just begging the issue of putting a patient into this situation where she has excess embryos. Now,
mm-hmm.
what some physicians say who disagree with me on this is that, how can you do this? What if they have to go through another egg
mm-hmm.
retrieval because they didn't have enough embryos to get pregnant?
Mm-hmm.
But to me, you have to weigh the benefits of getting pregnant and the risk of potentially a monetary mishap of having to go through another IVF cycle against the very real possibility that you're going to put this couple into a very difficult dilemma as far as what to do with their leftover frozen embryos. And to me, to not even address that issue with the couples up front is just not good practice. And,
mm-hmm.
and I discuss this with all of my patients, and I recommend limiting the number of eggs that we inseminate. Now, sometimes that's three or four, and sometimes that's more often, it's 12 or so embryos. But in general, our success rates with IVF are so good at this time, at least in the typical patient. We're not talking about a 42-year-old. You'd never get that many
mm-hmm.
eggs. But in general,
right.
IVF success rates are so good that to inseminate an unlimited number of eggs, to me, seems to be irresponsible without at least talking to the patient
mm-hmm.
about it first and saying, if we do this, you're very, very likely to be done with your family and still have embryos in the freezer.
Mm-hmm. I think Dr. Keenan brings up a really good point, too, that you have to think of the mental state that these families are in. I mean, they have been trying for so long to have a children, they almost cannot see past the IVF and the fertilization of those eggs. to see that there are embryos in the future. They're just shooting for one baby, and they've had so many unsuccessful attempts that just, you know, psychologically just wear on them.
Well, and money is an issue, too. And that was Ruth speaking, Ruth Claiborne. And money is an issue as well for families who are saying not all families are wealthy enough. And quite frankly, with the lack of insurance, general lack of insurance coverage for infertility treatment, it puts families in a difficult position. But let's go back, Suzanne, to you. So you had 23 embryos and four children. And at this point, you decided our family really is complete. What options did you consider, and how did you decide on a embryo donation to another couple?
Well, my husband and I felt the same way that Deborah and her husband felt. We had worked so hard to have our family, and we really looked at these embryos as children, and we wanted to acknowledge that and continue that moving forward. So adoption was really the only option that we looked at, and our fertility clinic did offer to us an opportunity to do that anonymously, but we wanted a little bit more control over what the future of these children would be. We knew that there would be children that would result from these 23 embryos. I mean, that just the odds for that meant that there was going to be at least a child out there. So we wanted to have a little bit more control over who they were going to. So we used an organization that allowed us to almost to the point of hand select the characteristics that we were looking for. We offered through the organization that we'd be willing to do a closed or an open adoption, and it just so happens that the couple that we got paired up with were also willing to do an open adoption. And when we met, we spoke on the telephone first anonymously to ensure that we would both be comfortable, and we decided on our own to meet, and we just developed a kind of relationship that it's been a very easy process for us to have this open adoption.
And you have kept in contact fairly regularly through the years, have you not?
We have. We've done everything from, you know, emails and phone calls and sharing photos to actually we've had a couple Thanksgivings together. We've met at the beach a couple of times. The kids right now, their children are 3 and 5. So we actually have not... We did not see them last summer, and we hope to see them by the end of this summer. But the intention is really not to build a relationship with the children. The intention is that we are really an extended family, and we really enjoy each other's company. And there just seems to be an added benefit that there is a genetic, you know, connection between us and their children.
You described it to me when we were talking before about the relationship felt like one of a cousin. And I like that because it's not like a sister, it's not like an aunt, but it is you view them almost as you would. They're still family, but not super connected, not super close. Would that be a fair summary of what you said?
I think for us that is a very good summary of how we feel about our adopting family.
Now, Deborah, y'all chose to donate anonymously. What was why did you make that choice?
Well, we did donate anonymously, but we were able to establish some criteria for the adopting couple. So, and they do have pictures of us and pictures of our daughters, so they could, you know, kind of see what if a child did result from the five, you know, what it might look like, and you know what we look like, and we provided medical histories on everyone in the family and that sort of thing. So much like, I guess, a closed adoption, live adoption, kind of thing. But we chose to not know who the family was simply because it was a really difficult decision for us, and I still, you know, sometimes wish we had another child, and I think it would kind of be heartbreaking if I were to know or to see pictures, and I just don't think it's something that my husband and I could handle, really, and so I think it would be better for everyone. I think if I saw pictures or even met a child that was biologically mine, even though it was really someone else's child and just, you know, shared my genetics, I would want to take it home. I would... I don't think I could handle that emotionally, so I think it's best for everybody.
And this
I think that
again.
A lot of go ahead, Ruth. Is that you?
Oh no, it was Suzanne. I was just gonna kind of spend a moment on what Deborah said and say
please.
That I think that that's where for a couple like us, where we already had a very large family and knew that we had a very large group of embryos, it was a much easier decision than someone in Deborah's situation. And I think mm-hmm. more families are in that type of situation where they're afraid that of those resulting feelings that they're going to get if they know what happens, but yet still having that courage to step out there and say, I still want to honor the life of this embryo.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Deborah, I think that the how you describe it is actually probably what a lot of people feel. It's just that the fear of knowing and feeling and what all that it would mean and all that. So I think that that's actually, you know, fairly common.
I think it may be what prevents some people or maybe shapes their decision for their embryo disposition.
I think it absolutely
does. The fear of these feelings and thoughts, because I do think about it. I imagine and I daydream about possibly there being a child and who he or she might be and what they're wondering. And I dream about it. I think about it. And I might not have all those feelings if we did have an open adoption, and I knew it might actually, you know, calm all those thoughts. But I think it's that fear that sometimes shapes people's decisions.
I think you're right. Ruth Claiborne, how does the process of either donating or receiving an embryo work? I mean, how would somebody, if they're considering it, how would they begin?
May I start at another place, Dawn, with,
sure.
with the whole planning thing? Because I think that's one of the angles that an attorney can bring to the process. And I was interested in everything that Deborah and Suzanne have said, and also what Dr. Keenan said about really having a conversation with the patient up front about whether or not to fertilize all of the eggs if there's a retrieval that results in a lot of eggs. And so a couple of things I would like to add to the discussion about planning ahead would be, first of all, to have some sort of a psychological consultation as part of the process to help talk through what and prepare for some of the emotions down the road.
This is prior to egg retrieval.
Prior to egg retrieval, and particularly for patients who are undergoing IVF for some reason other than egg quality, patients who have reason to think that they might produce a large number of eggs. Another part of the process that would be to talk with an attorney, as I believe it was Deborah said that they had done, about what just ensuring what would happen, would their wishes be followed if there were any remaining embryos. And so I think that's partly handled by documents that all patients sign at the clinic at the time of IVF that have to do with their plans for frozen embryos. If they're already remaining, but an additional piece of it, in a worst case scenario, if a couple died in a plane crash or something, the clinic might not necessarily even be aware of that death until they started sending storage fee notices. So I think it's important for all parents to have a will that covers who would be guardians to their children if they should die, that their will and any other documents that they have on file appoint a personal representative to make decisions about their embryos mm-hmm. and if they were not available to do so. And the personal representative needs to know that there are frozen embryos, and the clinic needs to know who the personal representative is so that they could get in touch with that person if notices went unanswered.
You know, we talked about this some last week, and it clearly is something that you have to take in. If you have frozen embryos, you need to take them into account in your estate planning, just to make certain that your wishes are implemented when you are no longer there. Dr. Keenan, how would someone with unused frozen embryos find someone who wants to become pregnant with them? And in the process of answering, can you also tell us a little about the National Embryo Donation Center?
Sure, Dawn. Well, the National Embryo Donation Center was founded in 2003 as a nonprofit entity to assist couples with the process of embryo donation and adoption, as well as to just educate the general population as well as the fertility population and actually fertility clinics, physicians, and allied health workers about this very important family building option. There are so many patients who are in the same predicament as Suzanne and Deborah. And right now in the United States, there are about 500,000 frozen embryos. And
probably probably a good deal more, but yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, perhaps a good deal more. And although the stated intentions of these couples are that 95% of them are going to use their embryos, we know from experience that that's not the case, that couples say for many, many, many years past when they really can realistically use these, that they are going to use them, and it's really that they're just not wanting to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, unfortunately, we're continuing to compound this problem by creating lots more embryos than we generally will need, and that is one of the things that we're trying to help with at the NEDC. Now, the as far as how a woman would go about trying to find an embryo donor, we have at the National Embryo Donation Center, and our website is embryodonation.org, a secure site where donors are listed anonymously and with just their biographical sketch, a letter that they write, and identifying information only as far as their height, weight, physical characteristics, medical history, and genetic background. And so a donor, if she he or if they donate embryos to the NEDC, can actually go online and peruse these anonymous recipients, and they will not know who the couple is, but they will say, well, I like this couple, I'd like to donate to them. Or they can also choose open donation, where they can look at these and a different group of donors and say, these are the ones that are at recipients, and these recipients have agreed to consider open adoption. And they can choose to have any degree of contact that they want with this couple. And so those arrangements need to be worked out by a mediator, an attorney, or an adoption worker.
And there are other organizations that also help match up. Let's see. Deborah, I believe you worked through your clinic itself, but Suzanne, you worked with Nightlight Adoptions, wasn't that right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and they have a Snowflakes program, and there are others. I've listed a couple of agencies, and as well as the National Embryo Donation Center on my website under embryo adoption, which is under both the infertility resources and adoption resources. So you can check that. In your experience, Dr. Keenan, how many people are going into this with an open relationship, and how many are going in anonymously with a closed relationship?
You know, at first, for some reason, it was a greater number, about two-thirds donating anonymously. But for the last couple of years, it's been about an equal number going into this openly and anonymously.
And I think, Suzanne, does Nightlight have both an open as well as a closed adoption program?
It does.
Okay, so that's.
I don't think that's correct, Suzanne.
If it is
new. It's very new because previously they had only open. They only agreed to work under open circumstances.
As an adoption attorney, in addition to a reproductive technology lawyer, I'd like to say that I was very interested in the trend that Dr. Keenan mentioned, because that's really been the trend in adoption over the years, to moving from mm-hmm. anonymity to more openness, and it really varies, and the arrangements can be tailored to fit the people involved on both sides of the equation. But mm-hmm. it is a trend.
There's also a fair amount of adoption research on traditional adoption, which supports the notion of openness. That's been done long enough now that there's some interesting longitudinal studies, but it's clearly not for everybody and for every situation.
Well, I think the thing, too, that needs to be defined is what is meant by open versus closed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're talking about the requirements of an open adoption, whether it's sharing pictures or mm-hmm. having the last name of the couple, because I know even when we still to this day we sign yearly relinquishment forms, and they always do not include our adopting family's last name or their address on that form to maintain. That's just their standard of maintaining that privacy.
This is Suzanne and, speaking, and she's speaking of her experience with Nightlight. Uh-huh.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I think that that would be important to try to explain that difference between what is meant by an open adoption.
Well, and there's so many degrees of openness, I think, is, and that's a valid point, that openness can simply mean that you exchanged rather detailed information, but you never see each other, and you don't even exchange pictures, or it can be in any degree. Ruth, I wanted to ask you a specific question, kind of from a legal standpoint. I know that in all states, a parent cannot consent to an adoption before birth. So how does this impact the donation of embryos?
Well, I think generally speaking that there's confusion and I guess differences of opinion about whether it should be termed embryo donation or embryo adoption.
Yes,
personally,
it's a fairly controversial subject, isn't it?
It is a controversial subject, but I think that from a legal perspective it is more accurately termed donation because you're correct that an adoption would not occur before a child was born, and that because at the time one becomes a recipient, it in a legal sense, and people certainly have different religious and ethical views of when personhood begins, but in a legal sense, the recipient couple is receiving an embryo and not a child. And so what's generally done is there is a very strong presumption that the woman who gives birth is the mother. For all of human history, if you could be there when a woman gave birth until about 1982 when egg donation began, the woman who gave birth literally, medically, had to be the mother. And so state laws pretty much across the board presume that the woman who gives birth is the mother unless there's a different court order such as an adoption or a declaration of parentage that we would do in a gestational surrogacy type case. And that really puts the premium on very well written donor recipient agreements, contracts
mm-hmm.
that are entered into at the time that the donation is made and the recipient agrees to accept those embryos. And in the case of an agency, I don't presume to speak for NEDC or for Nightlight, so maybe Dr. Keenan would want to talk about what kinds of documents they have. I recommend to my clients that there be donor and recipient agreements with the medical facility that actually performs the transfer, also with the agency if there were a matching agency such as NEDC involved. And I also recommend that there be an agreement directly between the donors and the recipients. And in case of an anonymous donation, this can be done by using initials or by using even Jane Doe's and signing on separate sheets of paper, and then the signature pages are held in escrow, so to speak, by the attorney or the agency handling the arrangement. But I think that makes a stronger case down the road.
You are listening to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility and Adoption. Today, my guests are Dr. Jeffrey Keenan. He is the director of the National Embryo Donation Center. Ruth Claiborne is an attorney specializing in reproductive technology and adoption law in Atlanta, Georgia. And Deborah Bond and Suzanne Gray are both former IVF patients and embryo donors. Ruth, how much does it cost to adopt an embryo?
To receive
an embryo. Let's avoid the adoption term. How much does it cost for a couple wanting to receive an embryo?
I couldn't speak to the medical costs at all, and different arrangements are made. In some cases, the recipients might help defray some of the costs of the IVF. I know some agencies have a policy and some clinics have a policy against that, but there's no legal reason, at least in Georgia, that a recipient could not contribute to some of the expenses of creating the embryos. And of course, the recipient would have her own medical expenses to prepare and receive the transfer.
Mm-hmm.
As far as a legal contract, among the couples, I think that would really vary depending on whether the agency already had contracts in place, in which case some of the fee would go to the agency and a smaller fee would go to an attorney who would review those contracts and advise. If an attorney were drafting a contract between donor and recipient, I think it would range anywhere from around $1,500 for drafting and negotiating, and particularly in a more open arrangement, the contract would be more detailed depending on the wishes of the parties. I think it would range from about $1,500 to perhaps $2,500 depending on the people involved and
that's the legal aspect, not mm-hmm, it's not mm-hmm, including the
yes,
medical. Yeah. Dr. Keenan, how much is there a range that you throw about for people to know who are both for the couple that is receiving the embryos? And then my next question is does it cost for the couples who are donating?
Sure. Great question, and we'll take the the second part of that first. No, there is no cost to the couple who donates the embryos, and in fact, we asked them to have some, repeat medical testing done, and also there is a cost for shipping the embryos here. But the NEDC pays all those costs, and even up to $400 in reimbursement for past storage fees to the couple. Although it is legal to do so, we don't believe it's ethical to buy or sell embryos, and so we would not pay the donors per se for embryos, although we would reimburse them for those costs that I mentioned.
Then the storage cost, not the cost. Can they get any to help defray the cost, their medical cost for creating the embryos?
No, we don't do that, and. There are a number of reasons why, but we don't want to make it an economic incentive for couples to donate embryos. We think it would be a mistake for couples to donate embryos because they needed the money. I think that would potentially lead to regret. As far as the recipient costs, at the NEDC, if you include the home study that we require and all of the medical costs, this number averages between $5,500 and about $7,000 at the present time. So the costs for this are actually quite a bit lower than the costs for an IVF cycle, a fresh IVF cycle, and substantially lower than the costs for domestic or, of course, international adoption. In addition, we have a pregnancy rate, an ongoing pregnancy and delivery rate that is as good or better than the national averages for an IVF cycle. So the costs by far favor embryo adoption compared to even standard IVF and certainly compared to traditional adoption or donor egg IVF. So the costs are fairly minimal. They can be higher in other places. Some agencies do charge for embryos. They do sell embryos by the embryo. We don't believe you should buy or sell human life. And then other agencies charge quite a significantly higher agency fee than we do. We work with Bethany Christian Services, and they've managed to keep their fees quite low for us. There will be an increase in those fees pretty soon, but it's very, very cost-effective for patients right now.
Now, you mentioned that the donating couple, and I should also say that I'm using the word couple, but in fact it can be a single person who has created these embryos, but for ease in conversation, I'm just going
sure
to use the word couple. But the donating couple must go through certain testing. What type of testing is this, and how invasive is it?
Well, basically, it's a blood draw from the couples. That is all that is requested by the FDA. However, it is not absolutely required by the FDA, but we do like to try to give that reassurance to the recipient couple.
What are you
this
testing
couple has
for?
Been retested. Infectious diseases, HIV, hepatitis, and syphilis are what we're testing for. Generally, we like to know the donating couple's blood types as well. Often they already have that information for us.
Ruth, are there many families that are eager and waiting to adopt embryos? And I'll throw that out to either Ruth or to Dr. Keenan. Ruth Claiborne.
I would say it's a growing number at this point. Like many of the other options in assisted reproduction, it's less well known than some others. I have when couples come to see me about traditional adoption, it's been my practice for several years now to also at least introduce them to some of the options available in assisted reproduction. And, for example, with gestational surrogacy, many of my clients thought that was something that California movie stars did but didn't realize that it had made it into the mainstream, so to speak. And I think with embryo donation, we're in a similar situation. I think many people are generally aware that it exists, but they don't know much about how to access it themselves. And the clinics, most patients tend to assume that unless they can be matched through their clinic, that it may not be available. And because many patients with frozen embryos, as we've talked about, haven't decided what to do yet, the clinics are probably have more potential recipients as patients than donors who have already made that decision. But I think that as time goes along, people are becoming more aware of organizations such as NEDC, and also a number of us who are attorneys who are in the practice, and a number of traditional adoption agencies are becoming involved in helping match embryos and recipients as well.
That would include Nightlight and Bethany and others.
Yes.
You know, there's been some very interesting research done by Dr. Anna Drapkin-Lowerly, and it was published this past year, on options, disposition options that people are choosing or say they will be likely to choose for their frozen embryos. And the one least chosen option is donating to another couple. Suzanne, why do you think that is?
Well, I think it might have a little bit to do with people not really understanding that donating families really have the best intention for the embryo in their hearts, and they would really like to do that, but there are all those doubts, like Deborah talked about, of, you know, I think about this, I dream about this. It's really trying to take that step of courage and hang on to the fact that you have, that you want the best for that embryo, and that giving that embryo a future, whether it's with your family or with a different family, is still better than not giving that embryo any future at all by leaving it, you know, frozen for, you know, eternity.
You know, in some of my interviews, I've heard from donating couples that their decision to donate their embryos to another couple has been misunderstood and not been readily accepted by their friends and especially by their extended family. Deborah, have you shared your decision with your friends and extended family, and have you found them to be accepting?
My family was very accepting, although I don't know if it has anything to do with it, but there has been a lot of traditional adoption in my extended family. So adoption is kind of part of our way of building our family, so
mm-hmm.
they thought it was really neat and interesting, although my parents did remind me, you know, they said you have to prepare yourself that if children do result, and even though you did a closed adoption, that you very well may meet when they're older, and you just need to understand that. So they were great. They counseled us, and we talked about it, but very supportive. And my friends, too, they think it's really interesting. I'm a writer, and I've written about embryo adoption, so
mm-hmm.
my friends read what I write, and they always know what I'm working on. So they're pretty familiar with it, but all of them, to the last one, had never heard about embryo adoption until I brought it up.
I think, yeah, that's true. I should mention that Deborah is a very good writer, and I'm going to hope, as soon as I can get my act together and get the Infertility Stories page up on my website, I'm hoping to reprint some of her really well-written stuff on embryo adoption as well as other things.
And Dawn, can I make a comment about that?
Sure.
You asked why couples are reluctant to donate their embryos. There is no doubt that a big concern is consanguinity or the possibility that one of their children might marry a sibling unknowingly, okay? Mm-hmm. And there is also the concern that many people express, that, gee, I couldn't stand, you know, being going around my town or my state or whatever and being afraid, seeing a child who looks like one of my children and thinking, gee, maybe that's my child. And that although that's not really a very rational concern, if you really look at the statistics or the numbers, it is a concern that people have, and that's why at the NEDC and Snowflakes and others, you can choose a recipient from a different state. You can choose one from Alaska if you're from Hawaii or if you're from Florida so that you don't have those concerns. So we do try to put people's minds at ease about that. Other couples just say, well, you know, this is my child. How could I give it away? And my concern there is that people aren't thinking that if they really feel it's their child, then how could they discard it? Because that is the only other option. And we don't consider indefinite freezing as an option. I think that's very important, because why are you going to pass this problem or this issue on to your children? And that, I think, is just profoundly unfair to your children to pass the stewardship of these embryos on to them just because you don't know what to do. So we really feel that it almost shouldn't even be stated as an option, because unless you're going to live forever, you cannot take this responsibility forever.
And Dr. Keenan, this is Suzanne. That's a good point. We actually had to change the executor of our will when we did own the embryos, because that person was not willing to manage it when we had not made a decision at the point when we hadn't had our fourth child at that time.
Right.
How did you raise the issue with the executor? You were apparently had talked with an attorney or just had been counseled somehow, because that's, I think a lot of people don't think about it. So you had to raise the issue and talk with your executor and say, are you willing to abide by our wishes?
Oh, absolutely, because we did have that reflected, just like Ruth Claiborne mentioned, we did have that reflected in our will, because we wanted to ensure that, you know, all the, you know, things were taken care of if something happened to us, you know, and we weren't able to make those decisions on our own.
It's one thing I really hope people hear. I'm sorry, go ahead, Ruth.
I just wanted to say that I think the considerations would be very much like who you would choose on your advance directives to make medical decisions for yourself if you were incapacitated. We're all more aware after the Terry Schiavo case that we should have a living will or durable power of attorney for health care, and that person needs to be someone who understands our wishes and would carry out our wishes. And similarly, the guardians for children in your will should be the people among your close circle of family or friends who would raise your children in the way that you would hope. And I think it's very, very similar. I'm not promoting indefinite storage. I think that at some point all couples who have frozen embryos should make a decision about it. But the importance to me of having a personal representative would be if something untimely were to occur.
Yeah, and that does happen. Deborah and Suzanne, have you or will you tell your children about your decision? And what type of relationship do you expect that the genetic siblings will have with each other, now or later? Deborah, why don't you start with that?
Yes, I absolutely will tell my children about it. We tell them pretty much everything.
Yes.
So, yes, we will. When, you know, maybe when they're a little bit older and understand reproduction, because they're only 5 and 7, so they're still pretty cloudy on the whole baby-making business. So, yes, we absolutely will. And I think we'll talk to them, too, about if and when, I think it's probably more when, we contact the fertility agency or contact an adoption agency and write a letter and say that we are open to contact if any children did result and if they want contact too. I think our children will be part of that decision.
Suzanne, how about you?
Well, my children are older, so they do know, and of course they've met our adopting family and have met their children, so they know and understand it. I think it's important, and I think Deborah probably thinks of this too in the same way. I mean, both Deborah and I really respect the life that these embryos represent. And with Deborah's two girls, I have three girls of my own. You know, it is a statement that our family's making about the preciousness of this life.
And, you know, my girls will understand that as they get older. And they'll also have to understand that, that birthright of you're going to have a child, because my girls may struggle with infertility as well. And I need for them to understand that it's not necessarily a birthright that you will have your own child, but there are other options, and you can be blessed through those other options as well.
Dr. Keenan, in your experience, are parents, the adopting or the receiving parents, telling the subsequent children that are born that they're adopted?
Well, you know, we don't have good data on that. I can tell you from my discussions with these couples that we recommend that. We strongly recommend that because the way that things are going in medicine, now is very heavily in the way of genetics, and it's getting more and more likely that children will know because of conditions that they might develop at some point that they were not the genetic progeny of their parents. And so we strongly recommend that, and most couples say, yes, we absolutely are going to tell the children. But to do follow-up on that is something we and others really haven't done yet as far as embryo donation. As far as sperm and egg donation, there has been follow-up, and it appears that a lot of couples who intended to tell their children do not tell their children, and so probably embryo donation and adoption is going to fall along those lines, although we don't know that for certain.
We raised the issue. I was going to point out that to the extent that you can draw any correlation from egg or sperm donation, I think that the research is fairly interesting and surprising. Let me throw out, just in case somebody is listening, I've only been able to find one book for children, and it's titled Before You Were Born, Our Wish for a Baby, The Story of a Donor Embryo. There are, and I have that under Infertility Resources Books for Children on my site, and how you can order that. You could also consider, and I have a long list of books for kids that explains adoption in general, although they wouldn't be right on target. But there are, and I have a long list of these books as well, on and I strongly recommend them, books that talk about how families being created, and a family could be created in lots of different ways, but they're still family just the same, that gist of book. That those books would also be useful for families who are wanting to begin the dialogue, and some of those are also listed under those books would be listed under the adoption resources page or under books.
Dawn, may I chime in a second? This is Ruth. There is a book by a psychologist in Atlanta named Linda Stamm that is basically a storybook to read to a child who is born as a result of donated eggs. And I don't recall the title right now, but I can email it to you. And I think that the history of adoption bears out that disclosure to the children is really very, very important. And I think it's the birthright of every child to know his or her true genetic history to the extent that parents know it, and that not telling really eventually will cause confusion and sometimes feelings of betrayal. And so I think that in time it may be, and I believe it is correct, that some families are choosing not to disclose now. And I think that as their children age, that there will be questions that demand answers in even difficult situations where a child might be in need of a transplant or something, and no one in the family would be a match. That's a terrible time to tell a child for the first time. So I just hope that parents who are choosing embryo donation and egg and sperm donation will pay attention to the lessons of adoption.
I do have a number of books. I would love to add this book as well that you're speaking of, but I do have a number of books on egg donation. But I only know of one that's specific to donor embryo, but I think you're right. You can, you know, make the you could use it as a conversation starter, regardless if it's directly on point. Suzanne, now, given the number of embryos you had, you donated to another couple, and they've created two children through those. Well, who decides what happens to the embryos that are left after, assuming they don't use up all the embryos?
Well, if they choose not to use all the embryos that they have available to them. The contract that we have between us, the adoption agreement, which is actually a transfer of property, sends the embryos back to our control, and that's they are basically saying, you know, we're done with our family, we don't want any more children, and you can now decide what you want to do from this point forward.
So ultimately, you still have a voice. You have not turned over the control completely. You still have a voice in it.
I think that that's just the way that the transfer of property works, and I would love to hear how Dr. Keenan is managing that now, because, you know, this was, you know, more than 10 years ago when
that's
when
not
our
how
original.
It worked for us. This is Deborah.
Okay, yeah, Deborah, tell us how it worked for you, and then Dr. Keenan, will you say how that works? Deborah, first tell us your experience.
In our experience, the way we didn't know there was another option, but the way it was explained to us was it is a transfer of property. So once we relinquished, donated the embryos, the adopting family, they were theirs to do it as they wish. So if they did have children and there were still embryos left over, that couple then would make the choice whether to donate them again or to dispose of them as they wished.
I think our agreement had in it, and this is the nice thing about being involved in this, is that I suppose you can write an agreement as you see fit. But our agreement was, you know, once they became pregnant, that they wouldn't abort the child. Our agreement was also that they wouldn't dispose of the embryos. And so I guess, you know, that was again back to us, you know, wanting to ensure that there was the best possible future for these embryos, and therefore, if they were done, we did not want them to feel the stress of saying, oh, my gosh, now what are we going to do? We were willing to take that back on ourselves,
mm-hmm.
and it was just our understanding that we would, you know, work with them to try to determine what that next step would be.
And Dr. Keenan, how are you? Go ahead, Ruth. You want to jump in here?
I think it's a good example of that it's important to have individualized agreements among the people directly involved. And if a person is a potential donor, that to think through these issues and negotiate that at the beginning, whether you would want the ownership of embryos to revert back to the original couple, or whether you would leave that decision with the recipient couple or with an agency. But it's important to make it suit your family.
Ruth is exactly right, and we handle things in a similar way to what I guess Suzanne was or it was just mentioning. We will donate set of embryos to a recipient, but if they choose not to use all of those embryos, then the donating couple makes a determination to either then retake control of them, or that those embryos be placed anonymously through the NADC, so that no embryos are discarded. Obviously, if these couples wanted to consider discarding embryos, then they would have done that rather than donating them. And so most couples, well, none of our couples really are comfortable with that. So that's why there is always a decision made to donate rather than discard, even if the original recipients of the embryos don't use them.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was in doing research for my upcoming book, I was interviewing a bioethicist, and he said something I had not really thought about. He said he questioned why would somebody want to adopt an embryo created by an infertile couple, since that may be indicative of genetic problems. So I guess that raises the issue of what are the genetic health considerations with frozen embryos created by an infertile couple? And I guess I'll throw this to you, Dr. Keenan, since you're the
doctor. Sure. I mean, I think that's just a significant lack of knowledge on the part of the bioethicist. And I think it's
well, I mean, it's possible for genetic issues to be.
Well, yes, but I mean,
for infertility issues to be.
Oh, but that is such a minority of these couples. And the only time where it comes into play with any frequency is in the case of men who have very, very few sperm cells, oftentimes that is genetically transmitted, okay, and who have such a low sperm count that the only procedure they can choose is the in vitro fertilization with ICSI. And that's only several percent or probably 10% of men that go that have this problem with what we call male infertility. It is very, very rare. In fact, you do not treat other chromosomal problems with in vitro fertilization, such as balanced translocations and things like that, with the extremely rare exception of those couples that choose to do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And those you could count, you know, on two hands in a year in the United States, probably.
And that's the ability to genetically test embryos at a very, very early stage by removing one cell and testing for certain, well, not all genetic diseases are certainly able to be tested for, but some are, and some are,
yes,
of course, gender-related, yeah.
Right, but infertility itself is not a genetic issue, with the exception of those certain male factor patients that I just mentioned.
I've been interested in my practice that not all of my clients are infertile. Either some of them are undergoing IVF because of a heart issue or a kidney problem or some other health issue, and so that would be a different circumstance.
Well, and in that case that you just described, that would be IVF through surrogacy, would it not be?
Right.
I mean, in using
right.
surrogacy, because
That's
I wouldn't
correct.
Imagine.
That's right.
right.
Uh-huh.
Well, either that or as I said, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And I'll mention that we have a group who has agreed to receive any of these embryos that are discarded or deselected, if you can use that term, through PGD. That is, if a couple comes in with a polycystic kidney disease and they do genetic testing and they do not use those embryos, rather than discarding them, we will accept those embryos and we will find a home for those embryos, even though the genetic parents consider them abnormal and unacceptable.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying that when you have an embryo that has a known genetic defect, be it cystic fibrosis or hereditary or genetically based kidney problem or any other of the genetic based, that there were people who would implant them and bring them to light knowing that these children would...
Yes. Yes, yes, there are. And we work with a group called CHASC. That
What's the name of the group?
CHASC, and that's
it's an acronym.
Children Homes for Christian Homes and Special Kids, I think is the acronym. And yes, they adopt children with who are born with genetic or physical deformities, and they will also undergo embryo adoption for these same embryos.
And have any embryos been donated with a serious genetic condition and been brought to life through CHASC?
Not yet. Although there are a couple of these that are pending.
Okay, guys, as always, this always happens. We have reached the end, and I still would like to keep talking. Thank you so much, Ruth Claiborne, Dr. Jeffrey Keenan, Deborah Bond, and Suzanne Gray for being here today and sharing your expertise and your experience. It has been great.
Thank you very much, Dawn.
You're welcome. I want to remind everybody that there is a conference starting tomorrow on emerging issues in embryo donation and adoption. It's going to be in Washington, D.C. If this show has whetted your appetite for more information and you live in the area, I'm sure you can still attend. You can get information on it at www.embryoconference.org. You've been listening to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. This show is live every Wednesday from 12 to 1 Eastern Time. You can replay this show or download it as a podcast from iTunes, and you can get both the replay and the podcast from creatingafamily.com. I have resources on embryo disposition on my website, Creating a Family, under both the infertility resource section and as far as donation, I have it under embryo adoption, under the adoption section. To find out about other shows, you can sign up for the updates from the homepage of creatingafamily.com. Next week, the June 4th show, we'll talk about the option of donating your embryos to research. And in June, I want to mention that I have three great adoption shows coming up. On June 11th, I will interview the author of the No Cry Sleep Solution books. And on June 18th, we're going to talk about the state of international adoption with a around-the-world tour with the CEO of the Joint Council of International Children's Services, as well as a representative of the U.S. State Department Division on International Adoption. And on June 25th, I'm going to be interviewing the author of Raising Your Spirited Child. If you haven't read this book, it is a tremendous resource. According to the CDC, 7.3 million people are infertile. If you're suffering from this disease, you are not alone. There are resources available to help. You can find some of these resources at creatingafamily.com. Thanks for joining us today, and I will see you next week. Bye-bye.